Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Debbie Brook, founder of Homeopathy World Community, will be speaking with our co-host today, a regular co-host, Alan Phillips, attorney at law from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, a specialist in vaccine rights waivers and exemptions. We'll also have our special once a month guest, Greg Glazer of California, specialist in constitutional law with us. Today is December 8th, 2011. We hope that these shows have supported and educated you through the legal maze and issues in the United States and helped to motivate you to investigate for yourself when your rights have been stepped upon. I wanted to start today with a little quote from Abraham Lincoln. He said, "Those who deny freedom to others deserve it not for themselves." Perhaps our guest will expand upon that, but our topic for today is due process in the medical context, the often excessive intervention of courts in medical decision-making positions, I would say. And so we're going to be combining these two parts of our lives, the legal part and what we do about taking care of ourselves and our body. And I want to welcome our guests, Greg and Alan.
Hello, Debbie.
Good afternoon. Or good morning, I should say. Greg, it's morning for you in California, afternoon for us here on the East Coast.
Right. You probably have a specific instance of something that you are thinking of when you talk about this issue of when there's excessive intervention in the courts. So are you looking at specific cases, or is this more on a philosophical basis?
Yes, I'm going to be looking at specific cases in particular. When I think of the issue, in my mind, I know of all of these Supreme Court cases such as Cruzan and Jacobson that go into detail on when courts can intervene in medical decision making. And then in my mind, I suppose I also picture a judge on the bench with a stethoscope.
Oh, well, is he allowed to do that? He does not have the, unless he is also an MD, I don't think that he has the ability to make those decisions unless he has really, really great advisors who are
right.
Physicians.
Some kangaroo court, you can imagine.
That's a real interesting point that Debbie makes there, though, is that, and this is where I see a lot of confusion in my practice area with exemptions and waivers, where people want to grab an alternative medical doctor and pull them into court and have them explain to the court what the real truth about vaccines is. And nobody would like to see that hit the light of day than me and others who share similar views on the vaccine controversy. But isn't it true, Greg, that the role of the courts is not really to evaluate the science, but rather to evaluate the weight of the evidence? And so what I tell people when they want to do that is that usually, of course, it'll depend on the specific situation, but usually I think that's not a good tact because for every alternative medical doctor you can bring in who will spout what maybe those of us in this conversation would consider to be a truth about vaccines, you've got 1,000 other doctors in the CDC and federal and state agencies who favor vaccination, and often there's a different tact that's needed strategically in court.
Yeah, I'll jump in on that one. There's a Supreme Court case from 1990 called Washington versus Harper, where the court allowed recommendations of two doctors to justify forcibly medicating a prisoner. And the court went into some very interesting analysis on that point that we're talking about here, which is, when does the judge make the decision versus when do the doctors get to make the decision? And the court analyzed the policy of it, and they said that due process is not violated by the use of informal, traditional medical investigative techniques, and that the mode and procedure of medical diagnostic procedures is not the business of judges. Although we acknowledge the fallibility of medical and psychiatric diagnosis, we do not accept the notion that the shortcomings of specialists can always be avoided by shifting the decision from a trained specialist using the traditional tools of medical science to an untrained judge or administrative hearing officer after a judicial-type hearing. Sorry for the long-winded quote. And that actually is a good springboard to discuss what is due process, because it is this constitutional protection of due process which comes up so frequently in these Supreme Court cases and other court cases that are discussing one's medical liberty. So what due process comes from the United States Constitution, and also probably your state constitution, certainly is in my state constitution, and it is in the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. It says that no person shall be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. Now, it was a very, it's a very open-ended statement to include in a constitution. And so over the years of the nation's legal development, the courts have interpreted what this means. And so today, I'll give you a very, very recent quote of what it means. It comes from a case called Washington versus Glucksberg. It was denying the right to assisted suicide. And this is Justice Rehnquist was writing, and he said, "The due process clause guarantees more than fair process, and the liberty it protects includes more than the absence of physical restraint. The clause also provides heightened protection against government interference with certain fundamental rights and liberty interests. In a long line of cases, we have held that, in addition to the specific freedoms protected by the Bill of Rights, the liberty specifically protected by the due process clause includes the rights to bodily integrity." And it goes on to say more, but then I'll just pick up the quote again. "We have also assumed and strongly suggested that the due process clause protects the traditional right to refuse unwanted, life-saving medical treatment." And so that's a very helpful quote. And as Alan and I have talked about on the show before, due process in the big picture has two components. On one side, it's protecting your right to life, liberty, and property. And on the other side, it's saying that in the process of protecting those rights, you're going to be entitled to certain judicial procedures, like the right to a fair trial and so forth. You know, the right to have a notice of the charges brought against you. In certain circumstances, it's the right to present... Well, in virtually all circumstances, it's the right to present evidence at the hearing and to cross-examine evidence brought against you. So,
goes just to the ideas of kind of fundamental fairness in common sense terms, wouldn't you say? That, is that a fair way to kind of generalize the procedural aspects that to make sure everybody's on a level playing field and has a fair shot at presenting their side of the case?
Yes, yes, and that's the language they use actually is very particularly helpful because it echoes what the Supreme Court has said specifically about due process and how it springs from notions of fairness. And in the medical context, we also find that a due process violation will arise when something, quote, shocks the conscience of the court. And so... What we find is that due process includes many very stark and unsettling cases that have some crossover with the Eighth Amendment, which, of course, is the prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. And I think a good place for us to begin our analysis, if you like, unless you guys had any further questions about that, would be on this case called Cruzan. And this is a very interesting case. It's Cruzan versus Missouri. And it's in this case, a woman was injured in an automobile accident. And she lost blood to her brain for, I think it was about 15 minutes. And if you lose blood to your brain for even 5 minutes, you're going to be in a serious, dire state. And you can lose your cognitive thought. And that's what happened to this woman. So she was put, she was in what's called, commonly known as a persistent vegetative state. And her parents wanted to withdraw the feeding tube from her. And her husband at the time didn't want to do that. And so the question was, well, what is, you know, what were her wishes? You know, does this woman who's in a persistent vegetative state, does she have the right to refuse medical treatment? And the Missouri law in question, the state law in question that the Supreme Court was deciding, you know, is this constitutional? Is it fair? What does due process require? The Missouri law said that there had to be all these procedures and clear and convincing evidence of the daughter's wishes. And so the court said that they liked that. The court recognized the right of this woman to refuse consent for forced medical procedures. In this case, it's a feeding tube. But they also said that in this case, there wasn't clear and convincing evidence that that's what this woman would have wanted. So they kept her on the tube. And in the process of deciding this case, the court went through a very long analysis of the right to bodily integrity, where it comes from, its historical origins, and what is the proper role of courts to step in maybe changing a person's personal decision, and then also regulating state hospitals. In this particular case, the woman was in a state hospital. So that's the background of the case. And for starters, the court said that the right of bodily integrity goes hand in hand with the doctrine of informed consent, where if you go to a doctor and they have to give – it's this tort doctrine. It says that they have to give you informed consent before you really consent. They have to inform you of the medical procedure before you can legitimately agree to consent. And the corollary is that, of course, you could withhold consent for a medical procedure. So it's this fundamental liberty interest. And as a famous Supreme Court justice once said, this is a time when he was in the lower court of appeals in New York, Justice Cardozo, he said that every human being of adult years and sound mind has a right to determine what shall be done with his own body. And a surgeon who performs an operation without his patient's consent commits an assault for which he is liable in damages. So that's the informed consent doctrine. And so the court discussed the how that translated also into the right to withhold consent. Now, let's go on to...
Well, can I ask you a question at that point? Did you see in Cruzan or elsewhere or otherwise, do you have thoughts about the idea of the relationship between informed consent in the general sense, bodily integrity, person, age of majority, and so forth, with regard to specific issues being consented? Because I can see, for example, in the Cruzan case, I can see this profound and just really, in one sense, very sad difficulty and potential for broad differences of opinion about whether or not a person in a persistent vegetative state should be kept alive. And I can see very easily how people could feel very strongly different ways on that issue. And there's not really a science answer, I don't think. There are questions of philosophical and religious nature underlying such a question or decision. Do you see, and so here's where I'm going with my question, do you see informed consent, as far as you've taken the discussion today anyway, and as you described it, with regard to an adult having the right to decide about their own body, as something that applies pretty generally and sweepingly, or do you see that maybe in the, for example, in the case of Kuzan, that it was very closely tied to the nature of the issue of the particular facts in that situation?
Yeah, I'd say that it was used as a historical basis for the Kuzan decision, but your point is well taken that it does have a very sweeping nature by itself. I mean, the right to informed consent, you can even find it, if you want, in the Nuremberg proceedings, trials for the war criminals before the Nuremberg military tribunals under control capital law. This was in 1946, 1949, and they discussed permissible medical experiments. Now, we'll save our listeners the gruesome details of what those medical experiments were, but the outcome of the case, of the Nuremberg case, was that forced medical procedures are not lawful under international law. Quote, the voluntary consent of the subject absolutely is.
We're losing his sound today. Can you hear?
Is losing me?
Yeah, you're kind of going in and out. Maybe you're moving your head around or something. Sometimes that happens. What I wanted to ask you, can I go back to the Kuzan case just a little bit? A decision was made to keep the feeding tube in, and I don't know enough about the case. Is there a time period where it can be reevaluated? How many years a person could be living in a vegetative state, totally draining the family, and really this person is not in a state of being alive? And when would you decide, or physicians decide, that this person has really ended their life? And I think that maybe I've even heard of cases where people are in a coma for years and then suddenly awaken. I'm not exactly sure. It seems like a very tenable, a very sensitive area of discussion.
Yes, yes. On the timing issue specifically, that was one of the rationales that the court made in saying that they want to give the discretion to the medical professionals on the ground. Things can change, where either the patient can change their mind about something, and so what the court said is that they just wanted to just make the smartest decision they could. They recognized that there were competing concerns on both sides, and they just said that if they were going to make an error, they wanted to err on the side of protecting life.
Mm-hmm.
So they said that an erroneous decision not to terminate results in a maintenance of the status quo. The possibility of subsequent development, such as advancements in medical science, the discovery of new evidence regarding the patient's intent, changes in the law, or simply the unexpected death of the patient, despite the administration of life-saving treatment, at least create the potential that a wrong decision will eventually be corrected or its impact mitigated. An erroneous decision to withdraw life-saving treatment, however, is not susceptible of correction. So what they want to do is they don't want courts to have to come in every time something changes.
Okay.
You know, law is passed, or the patient changes their mind, or there's an advancement in medical science. They just want to say, legislatures, you make the procedures and give the authority to your healthcare practitioners, and then just check the law to make sure that the procedures are legitimate and that there's no offense to due process. But we don't want to get called in and have judges be putting on their stethoscopes here, because they're not qualified to do that.
Do you think this leaves the allopathic medical community potentially in an inappropriate decision-making position with regard to there might be other ways to evaluate the patient or view the context, view the situation?
You're asking about whether all of the information, all sides of an issue, are being put forth to the courts.
I guess, in a sense. I mean, in this particular issue with Kruzan, I don't, off the top of my head, have an issue of allopathic community being the ones evaluating that kind of a case. So maybe it wasn't entirely a fair question from my point of view, whereas I can see, for example, with a question about whether somebody should be forced to take chemotherapy when there is a long list, potentially, of so-called alternative or complementary approaches to cancer that might be more effective.
Or even if the person doesn't want to take it for no reason other than they don't want to. I mean,
well, I think what I understood Greg to say is that Kruzan supports the right of an adult to make that kind of a decision. It was just that this woman had not, there was not sufficient evidence that she had a firm position
exactly.
Prior to the point that she was in a condition where she couldn't speak for herself. And so it's sort of like the court came down in favor of informed consent, but there wasn't evidence in this case, and so they had to go err on the side of caution, not being clear about what the patient's wishes really were for herself in that situation.
So for anyone listening, it may be wise to put your desires down on paper, sign them, have a witness, and put them in a safe place so that that information is there in case of an emergency or any future. Go ahead.
And I don't always blow the lawyer horn on every situation and circumstance, but there are laws in probably every state, surely here in North Carolina, and I'm sure in California, that say what your rights are and what's the proper way to write them up and document them and so forth. So it might be an issue that you want to check in with an attorney about to make sure that your wishes are documented in a manner that they can be legally enforced.
Is this the same thing as a living will? Or is it a little different?
Well, in California, we call it an advanced health care directive, and you need either two witnesses or it needs to be notarized, and it has to clearly state that your intent regarding your medical decisions, and you designate an agent to make those decisions for you as well, according to your wishes.
Right, and there may be slight differences from state to state in terms of what the requirements are, so it's important to check with a lawyer in your state, about your state-specific procedure. But exactly, and there are people, for example, who write wills and they don't follow the proper legal procedure, and so the person passes away and their property is not distributed according to their wishes but according to the default state law because they didn't go through the proper procedure in the first place. The same sort of thing can happen here. So it is important to find out what the proper procedure in your state is.
Yeah, and on that point, actually, it's a decent segue to talk about procedures, because the court in that other case that we were talking about, the Washington case, Washington v. Harper, 1990, this was decided sort of in tandem with Kruzan, and this is where the court relied on the two doctors' recommendations to forcibly give the prisoner antipsychotic meds. Well, the court looked at the procedures that were involved there of the center, where they were administering those meds, and it gave this guy, and this guy had flip-flop, he wanted the meds and he didn't want the meds, and it gave him notice, the right to be present at an adversary hearing, right to cross-examine witnesses. He could have the committee members who were deciding it weren't allowed to be interested parties. They had and so what the court was saying is that absent any resulting evidence of bias or, that the decision was actually made before the hearing, something like that, like a very flawed proceeding, they're not going to interfere. So that is sort of a lesson, or you might say the writing's on the wall, for how you would expect to be treated if you resisted a medical procedure in the future. And so I was before the show, I was trying to, and as I'm reading these cases, doing my research for the show, trying to think of, what is a person who resists vaccines, a person who wants to be natural, what are they like in the law? Because we don't have many cases at all talking about forced vaccination. As Al and I have talked about before, we have the Jacobson case, but they're very hard to find, as scholar Wendy Mariner has also confirmed in her writing. She says, well, it is not, the Supreme Court has not decided a case that involved isolation or quarantine for disease. It has held that civil commitment for mental illness is unconstitutional unless the judge determines the person is dangerous by reason of a mental illness. So what we have here is we're looking by analogy to other cases, to cases involving being committed for a mental illness, you know, or let's say you're a an involuntarily committed mental patient would be analogous. A pretrial detainee, you know, this is where
Please tell us I'm not making the connection that the court is seeing here on being mentally ill, or what was your other situation?
Oh, yeah. And the reason why is because you're in custody, but you haven't committed a crime in the eyes of the law.
What are we in custody for, resisting a vaccination?
Yeah, that's a theory. Sorry, I should have set that up better.
In a declared emergency, if vaccines were mandated, or in a case of martial law or something like that, a state of emergency, and they mandate vaccines, and you say, no way, Jose, I don't do vaccines for whatever reason, religious or whatever, but. The most laws in the country allow the authorities to quarantine, and perhaps even in many, if not most, laws, to authorities get to decide the location of that. Mm-hmm. And if I'm understanding correctly, Greg, what you're going to here, of course, this raises a fundamental due process question: can you be put into a facility against your will without there being some sort of procedure where you have the opportunity to defend your case, essentially, your position?
Sounds to me, Greg, like if a person is resisting taking a vaccination, which is supposedly good for the masses, then they are mentally ill, that they cannot decide their individual right about their own bodily health, and they are deemed, I mean, when you make an analogy to a case regarding mental illness, just because they don't go along with the majority doesn't mean that they're mentally ill.
Yeah, and actually, that was just my own analogy and the analogy of Scholar Mariner. We haven't seen it yet being applied, that analogy being applied by the courts, but I figure if I'm mentally going there and Mariner's mentally going there, I imagine the court would go there as well. It's sort of a logical corollary.
I think Debbie's missing the analogy there, though. It's not about whether you're mentally ill because you refuse a vaccine. The point is that if you have someone who is, I mean, someone's not automatically assumed to be mentally ill if they commit a murder, though in my own personal assessment you would have to be, but legally you're not mentally ill if you kill someone. You still have to be evaluated to see whether or not you're mentally ill for purposes of can you go to trial. So we're not saying, I don't believe the analogy is about is somebody mentally ill if they refuse a vaccine. I think the question
around the presumption of innocence. You know, a person is presumed to be innocent until they've been adjudicated otherwise. And with a person who has been involuntarily committed to a mental institution, they're not capable of committing a crime. And so, or like a person who's a pretrial detainee, you know, they've been arrested and they're been incarcerated, but they're presumed innocent. You might have the same situation with a person who resists a public health order. They haven't actually committed a crime, but they've been incarcerated. And the incarceration, so I also looked at some cases involving detainees at Guantanamo Bay. These guys were force-fed food, and the courts denied their request for injunction to stop the force feeding.
They lost all of their rights when they went in there. I mean, they were not considered to have any jurisdiction over themselves, it seems.
Yeah. It's a unique. Case that's decided under international law more than due process of the United States.
And you did want to talk about international law today too, didn't you?
I did, yes, regarding the, in particular, what we learned from the Nuremberg trials.
Okay.
Just that the on medical experimentation. It means that the person involved should have the legal capacity to give consent to a medical procedure, and they have to be situated so that they have the, you know, the free power to choose. When I looked in particular, and now let's go back to U.S. law. When I looked in particular at the history of United States cases discussing the treatment of prisoners, it is a sad history. Oh, my gosh. This nation and the way that it treats its prisoners is scary. You know, I found stuff that would make those who conducted the conditions kind of, you know, shiver.
I would think that they would think of them as just animals. I mean, they have lost all of their rights. Although I don't know whether that is changing today with so many advocates for people in jail. Well, there are many different kinds of prisoners, I suppose, also.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I think it's, you know, it could be hit or miss depending on where you are, you know, what institution you're in, and
give us an example or two, if you would, Greg, of what you've seen historically and where you think we are now in terms of anything relating to medical care and treatment. Because I assume when we talk about the voluntary commitment of somebody who's mentally ill, there has to be someone who makes an assessment whether or not there's been a formal due process procedure for somebody to have the opportunity to argue that they're not mentally ill or that they can manage their mental illness without being committed or what have you. But what have we seen with in the prison system here, and what does that tell us about possible future rights with vaccines?
Yes. If you're treated like a prisoner, then your right to refuse medical procedures is incredibly diminished. But if you were treated like a free person, your right to refuse medical procedures is highly intact. And so the crux is going to come down to it's going to come down to self-quarantine in a situation where your only crime is resisting, and I use crime loosely, your only crime is resisting vaccination. So because once you get into that prisoner context and you start invoking these prisoner cases, then the state has the right to make to take reasonable precautions for the penological interests of its institution. And so that means that the state can not just protect others from you, but they could get to protect you as well. And the extent of a prisoner's right to refuse medical treatment is not well articulated in the situations involving like a transmittable disease, you know. So I would consider that once you're taken into custody and put into a quarantine relationship, into a quarantine situation, the likelihood that you'd be able to resist medical treatment for the underlying disease relating to the quarantine itself is low, based on precedent. But again, you know, just Mariner pointed out, we don't have these cases; they're just not out there. So we have to look to what the procedures are in state law and federal law. And as I pointed out, either a show ago or two shows ago, the specifics of the quarantine, quarantine procedures are not detailed at all, especially in my state in California. So you just have broad authority given to health officials to do quarantines, but the procedures involved for actually implementing those quarantines are not specified. So, you know, you just get what you get. And then according to these standards, all we have is that the right of authorities to care for prisoners is intact. I mean, they can care for you and they get to protect others from you. That's just the nature of a quarantine. So
now it sounds to me like you're equating the quarantine and prison context, and it seems to me that at least as a starting place, a quarantine would presumably be a civil versus criminal procedure or proceeding or action. But do we really have any law that you know of that sort of clarifies one way or the other the similarities or distinction between an emergency quarantine kind of context and prisoners who are locked up because of their crimes? Because it almost sounds to me like what you're saying, and it's a rather scary prospect, that almost ironically, we could be quarantined potentially for refusing a vaccine, and then for our own safety, if we're quarantined collectively somewhere, those of us who refuse vaccines, for our own safety, we could be forced to be vaccinated. Ironically, because the whole point of being in the quarantine facility in the first place would be because you refused vaccines and they were not forcing them on you.
Yeah. Yep. That's exactly what I'm saying. It's a catch-22, isn't it? You know?
Yeah.
And it would depend on the circumstances. And the great guidance given by the court here, by the Supreme Court, is that it won't offend due process if it is legitimately related to the penological interests of the institution. And then even then it would have to, in order to successfully wage a due process challenge, you'd have to, you know, shock the conscience of the court. And good luck with that in the vaccine context. I mean, when you have a medical doctor,
right,
you know, giving them, who's making the recommendations, or, you know, the CDC, this is for the, you know, the public benefit. And
please explain shock the conscience. How is that done and what does that mean? What does it look like?
Yeah, shock the conscience is going to come up in cases. Let me just pull up an example. All right, that'd be like the Rochin case. Okay, so in this one Supreme Court case, there was a guy who was suspected of selling drugs, and so the police, you know, approach him, and he swallows the drugs. And then the police do a medical procedure on this guy to forcibly get the drugs out of him. And I think they cut him. He swallowed the capsules, and then a doctor forced an emetic solution through a tube into Rochin's stomach. Okay, so they didn't cut him, but they put a tube down his throat. And this defendant vomited, and then the government, at a subsequent trial, the government introduced the evidence of the pills. And then this defendant said that shouldn't be introduced as evidence because his due process was not followed because they, you know, it's a forceful procedure. And what the court said, and this was a unanimous decision by the court, it said that respect for those personal immunities which are so rooted in the traditions and conscience of our people as to be ranked as fundamental or are implicit in the concept of ordered liberty. And that this, where did it say that it shocked the conscience? In the course of the opinion, it was that this conduct was so abhorrent as to one's liberty interests and what is expected in a civil society that it shocks the conscience of the court, and therefore it violated due process.
So forcing this suspect to vomit the evidence was considered to shock the conscience, is that?
Yeah.
Because it crossed the boundary of personal liberty even though he did something that was wrong and he hid the drugs, in terms of the law and your privacy of your personal body and what can be forced upon you. I mean, even if a police goes to you, they say the Miranda law, what do they say? They say something first to that you have a right before they can do something to you.
Right. Yeah.
So,
that case was decided on due process grounds and not on cruel and unusual punishment grounds. And the guy, mm-hmm. remember, he was a defendant in a trial. He hadn't been convicted yet. He was not a prisoner. He was a detainee. So, you know, that's similar situation as a quarantine relationship. And, you know, interestingly, I found a study. This was from 2004. So, this is post 9/11 here. This is from the New York Academy of Medicine. And they interviewed people to ask about their willingness to remain in an officially imposed quarantine location. And this may surprise you. A majority of individuals said they would go find their families unless they receive trustworthy information about their family's safety, and that only 43% of the people surveyed would obey the official recommendations to go to a vaccination site during a smallpox outbreak. And more than half of those expressed concern about the vaccine safety. So that's from 2004, okay, of people in New York. And so, and that actually meets with my previous research, as we had talked about several shows ago. Remember how we were talking about all those historical cases where local officials tried to implement quarantines and forced medical procedure orders, and like local officials were hunted down and people did not follow the quarantine orders at all? It's this idea that if you try to implement mass quarantine, it doesn't work.
I have a question. You said 43% would go to the vaccination site. Is that not high? Or maybe my perspective on percentages of population is different than yours.
40% of people not complying with an order, that's an incredible
amount of resistance. You saying would or would not go?
They would not. They would only 43% of those surveyed would obey the official recommendation. So
would obey. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, I did mix that up.
So 43% sounds like a lot. I would think 10% would not, you know, would obey, and 90%, that would be dramatic.
No, I would expect the other way around. I'd expect most people to do what they're told.
Yeah, you do or don't. You do or don't.
I would expect most people would do what they're told, and it would be a minority of people, of informed, self-informed people, who also not only had the information but the personality or emotional fortitude to go against what authorities were saying. I would think that would be a vast minority of people. So that 43% figure sounded pleasantly high to me.
Yeah,
wow.
And I think it's one of those situations where everyone's a hero when they're answering questions, but you know, when it comes down to the you know, the boots on the ground, it's a different story. But even still, you know, if people see that their neighbors are also resisting this order,
right? It would be follow the leader, follow what your neighbors are doing, and if people are in doubt or unsure, and some mandate is made, and then who do they turn to for advice and what is the proper thing to do? And if you know, so it would be kind of chaotic.
Yeah, and I wouldn't count in particular on the Supreme Court rulings to hold much sway during a period of chaos, which is why I get a little bit discouraged. You know, that these, you know, all these you know, useful judicial opinions and statements that the you know, of the rights of bodily integrity just get kind of pushed to the wayside when it comes to you know, one's right to refuse medical treatment and, you know, to the integrity of one's body. I mean, even prisoners have this right. I mean, even prisoners have this right, and the courts are just balancing it. They're saying, oh, well, you know, when you have a legitimate penological interest, then we'll uproot the right. But even there's some very strong cases saying that there's a substantial right. And then for free people, it's even more so. You know, even in the, you know, the right to bodily integrity in particular, you know, many lofty statements came out of the abortion cases as well. And, like, for example, Planned Parenthood versus Casey, 1992. This is a quote from one of the justices concurring. Our whole constitutional heritage rebels at the thought of giving government the power to control men's minds. The same holds true for the power to control women's bodies.
But the thing that comes up every time with vaccines, of course, as something that distinguishes the questions of vaccines from other kinds of medical decisions and medical procedures, is this notion that my being vaccinated is going to help protect you. And it's not the sole individual. It's sort of like, you know, the seatbelt laws. I think anybody who doesn't regularly wear their seatbelts is crazy. But I think the fact that, for example, here in North Carolina, it's against the law not to wear your seatbelt is also crazy, because if I'm not going to wear my seatbelt, I'm putting myself at risk and not anybody else, and I should have that decision. So to me, sort of the fundamental decision-making. But again, what always comes up with vaccines is that when I don't vaccinate, I'm putting others at risk. and this idea that we have to have some unnamed majority, an unnamed specific percentage, but majority of people vaccinated for everyone to be protected, and therefore if you're not vaccinated, you're putting others at risk. And what concerns me, not only just that all of the rules could go out the window when everybody's in a panic, which I have great concern about, as you just suggested as well, Greg, but that with vaccines, there's this additional rationale that, oh, well, vaccines are different. Do you have any thoughts about either the practical or legal technicalities there, Greg? Is there any evidence that you know of in the law or precedent that helps us argue that the bodily integrity should be upheld for individuals with regard to vaccines, despite this counter argument of, oh, well, here it's different, you have to protect other people when you get vaccinated?
Yeah, I do. And the rule comes from Jacobson, and it's that quote about how a man, you know, has the ability to resist and you know, intrusions upon his liberty, and it's the absolute will of him to do so. But in the same opinion, you know, the court is discussing that there are certain aspects of I'll just quote it, the Jacobson court. There are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good, up to and including the obligation to take his place in the ranks of the army of his country and risk the chance of being shot down in its defense. And then the court held, you know, that it cannot be adjudged that the present regulation of the Board of Health was not necessary in order to protect the public health and secure the public safety. So there you have it. You know, in a Supreme Court case on vaccinations, on a medical board saying that every resident of this jurisdiction has to undergo smallpox vaccination, they were saying that that is a legitimate use of the police power and that this individual was free to leave the jurisdiction. And so that's his self-help remedy.
So it's in analogy to the idea that we could be required by our government to partake in our national defense, we could be required by our government to partake in our community defense where vaccines are concerned, but the court left us an out there to alternatively to leave the jurisdiction so that it essentially becomes a moot issue. We're not a threat to anybody, whether or not we're vaccinated, if we go somewhere else.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, yes. am I hearing that,
yeah,
correctly?
Yeah, no, that's fair. You know, and I'll also quote, now, did you know that the court in Roe versus Wade discussed the Jacobson case? And they had a quote, and this will relate directly to what we're talking about here. Quote, "It is not clear to us that the claim asserted by some Amici that one has an unlimited right to do with one's body as one pleases bears a close relationship to the right of privacy previously articulated in the court's decisions. The court has refused to recognize an unlimited right of this kind in the past," citing Jacobson and Buck v. Bell. Now, that's a dangerous quote. It's like the quote is, you know, all right, we recognize that you have a fundamental right to your bodily integrity, but guess what? There's also cases that say that there's a limit on that right, such as Jacobson. Now, Jacobson case, as we know, is forced vaccination. And then the Buck v. Bell case, which is discredited, so I can't believe it showed up in Roe versus Wade. That's not an accident, by the way. We're related to sterilization. It was that the mentally retarded individuals could be forced to have sterilization. Now, the case was, you know, totally discredited, but there it is, cited as authority in Roe versus Wade. So.
Wow. So it strikes me, this notion that bodily integrity is not, potentially at least, not absolute in the discretion of our governments, as a potentially slippery slope that, you know, maybe the better rule, as I just, in very general terms, articulated what I understood you to say about Jacobson, is that you can be forcibly vaccinated, but there's a loophole. You can go away and make it a moot point, and then they don't have the need and therefore the ability to forcibly vaccinate you because you're not a threat anymore as they perceive it in that community. But boy, once you start chipping away at that, where is the line? And
yes, good question.
Boy, slippery slope there, it seems to me, potentially.
Yeah, it is. There's a case called Revere versus Massachusetts General Hospital, and in that case, the court said, when the state takes a person into its custody and holds him there against his will, the Constitution imposes upon it, the state, a corresponding duty to assume some responsibility for his safety and general well-being. The rationale for this principle is simple enough. When the state, by the affirmative exercise of its power, so restrains an individual's liberty that it renders him unable to care for himself and at the same time fails to provide for his basic human needs, food, clothing, shelter, medical care, and reasonable safety, it transgresses the substantive limits on state action set by the Due Process Clause. So I'm going to read between the lines for you on that one. They're saying that when the state takes you into their custody, they have an affirmative duty to medicate you. That is in your best interest. You know, that's your medical care. It's the industrial processing. You know, the writing on the wall here, listeners, is that don't get into the custody of the state. If you are put into custody, you will be just churned out in the same industrial fashion that prisoners are.
There's almost an understandable merit to this idea that if they're going to take you into custody, they've got to take care of you. The larger problem to me is not so much that statement as far as it goes, but rather who gets to decide when you get to be taken into custody, who gets to decide what is in your best interest when you're in custody. And when you get into, of course, the medical arena, you can quickly get into varying, if not sometimes wildly differing opinions on the answers to those questions.
Hey, folks, we have about 5 minutes left. Just want to give you a heads up.
Okay. You know, these due process cases are really interesting. And what I found, a common theme that I found, is that the courts are very happy to recognize the liberty interests, but they don't recognize, and Debbie, I think you'll appreciate this as a homeopathic practitioner, the courts don't go and recognize the value of naturalism, the value of holistic remedies. It's as if whatever the medical profession says, that's the standard. That's what public safety means. And so liberty interests are recognized as being, you know, inherently valuable, but not the actual value of being natural. And this isn't just the courts. You know, you find that there are many prisoner cases involve the prisoners, you know, actively trying to get the medical care. Yeah, and they sue for it, and then you find just some other bizarre cases. Like there's this one. This is a Supreme Court case, Riggins versus Nevada, and the state had put him on some anti-psych meds, but the petitioner, this defendant, he sued to challenge the meds because he wanted to show he wanted to go off the meds so he could show the jury and the court just how crazy he was in his normal state of mind to help prove his insanity defense. And so when reading the cases, you have to navigate specifically to find the most direct analogies. And should be some interesting reading and also some very terrible reading as well. The origin of the right to bodily security also has a in this sort of, a better way to say it is that there's the uncontrolled authority over the body, and
Greg, you're leaving us hanging. The Riggins versus Nevada. He went off the drugs. Was he totally insane from that, or was he in his right mind, or what happened?
Yeah, he was if I recall correctly, Riggins was a murderer, and he wanted to get off his psych meds so he could show the jury how crazy he was. And to help prove up his insanity defense. And the court just went with the doctor's recommendations.
Oh, He wanted to show that he was insane. Is that what you're saying? When he murdered people,
or yeah, he wanted? Yeah. Like, I guess when he was sitting in court, you know, the jury in the court could see his calm demeanor. And it was because he was psych meds, and he thought that if he could go off the meds, then
he could prove that he was innocent because he was insane.
Yeah, he thought it would help him prove up his insanity defense.
I see. So what is the outcome, and what do we learn from this in the last 3 minutes?
Oh, yeah, Riggins? Boy, you know, I just wanted to use that one to show. I don't think it relates as specifically to the point about vaccinations. That the point was that it didn't. That was the point that I was making, is that it's a case showing that not all of these due process cases are relating to someone trying to resist medications. And in some cases, you have prisoners actively seeking them, sometimes for different reasons, like this guy in his insanity defense. And so mm-hmm. you have to be very specific about which cases you rely on proving up your case.
Okay, so why don't we summarize today's show so that we kind of come to a conclusion. One thing I learned is that in order to sustain my liberties, that I should have a paper drawn up of my wishes for how I want my body be taken care of in any uneventful event that would not be keeping me in my sound mind at the time. And what else did we learn in general here?
Yes, that due process protects your right to life, to life and liberty, and it's a very strong right. And so long as you were, as long as you are a free person and not a prisoner, you can expect to keep that right, and you will be able to resist forced vaccination. In the event of an emergency declaration, the stakes get higher, and it would be good to have a medical exemption already completed, signed by your naturopathic practitioner or doctor, saying, you know, why vaccines would harm you, and with that in tow, you might be more likely to resist.
In many states, that would have to be a medical doctor.
Yeah, in particular, it's very helpful to have a medical doctor.
Well, Greg, we are delighted, as always, to have had you on the show. Greg is a superb legal researcher and legal analyst. And, Greg, you've added so many dimensions on your appearances to the vaccine issue and in particular, in your specialized area concerning emergencies and so forth. And it's just been really enlightening today. Really appreciate having you on. I've learned a lot.
Covered a lot of ground. Okay, until the next time, we'll see you next Thursday at noon.
Thank you for listening to Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S. with co-hosts Alan Phillips and Debbie Brock on Homeopathy World Community Radio. Remember to educate before you vaccinate.
Journeys can't be easy, so they do what we bring, the wisdom.